Hello and welcome to Pedagogzilla, the pedagogy podcast with the pop culture core, coming at you sort of almost not live. I mean, not when you're listening to this, but we're all together. Several of us are. Okay, we're not all together. This is Matt, coming at you from the Open University in Milton Keynes. And today we are answering the bloody stupid question, what can Jurassic Park teach us about embedding sustainability in course design? And answering that question, you have me, your host. I'm Mike Collins. I'm senior learning designer at the Open University. I'm a man with a small weedy truck full of microphones and a slight deficit of coffee. And I am joined in the room by...
Paul Astles, also learning designer at the Open University. Interesting fact about me is that I am the drummer in the best band that nobody's ever heard of.
Which we've got a clip of, actually, I think, in one of the other episodes.
Just a nice link back to a previous episode.
Fantastic.
Katrina Matthews, also a learning designer. Do you want a fun fact about me?
Yeah.
Oh, this is that awkward part at the start of icebreakers where you can't think of a fun fact, isn't it?
Katrina full on locked eyes at me. Oh, just pure terror.
Pure fear in my eyes.
What about the fact that you're now a pro cyclist?
I'm pro cyclist. I now own a bike after not having owned one for 3 years. So yeah, relearning to ride a bike, all those fun things.
Does the old adage prove true?
I managed to pedal. I didn't fall off. So yeah, I'd say so.
Congratulations.
Some sayings are true.
And we are also joined by the miracle of the internet from deepest, darkest other bits of England by...
Hayley Johns. I'm also a learning designer, so I support the Wells faculty at the Open University, and I work with Paul and Katrina on our sustainability projects. And yeah, I was also going to say deepest, darkest Devon, so I'm glad we're on the same page about that. I'm also racking my brains for interesting facts. I've got my emotional support blue tack with me to kind of squeeze during recording what's interesting about me. I mean, I love Jurassic Park. I guess that's the main reason why I'm here, is that I absorbed it as a 4-year-old and kind of can't get it out of my brain. So
I mean, it is an absolute banger. The other podcasts I do is with a disgraced archaeologist.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's a genuine disgraced archaeologist. He got thrown out of Egypt for a drunken night with a box of grenades.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Yeah,
genuine true story.
Wow.
Yeah. He's,
I can see why that would be a disgrace.
That's my dream job title, disgraced archaeologist.
Yeah, I know.
Amazing.
Right? Yeah, I'd put it on everything. I'd have a business card that said nothing else, not even my name. Anyway. So let's move into the first part of the show where we answer our question, what can Jurassic Park teach us about embedding sustainability in course design?
Part one, the question.
Okay, so what can Jurassic Park teach us about embedding sustainability in course design? There are two components to this. One is Jurassic Park and the other is sustainability. So let's maybe tackle Jurassic Park first. So I'll do a quick synopsis and I guess we can do the round table because I'm conscious we have some Jurassic Park experts here. So Jurassic Park, as you may know, originally a Michael Crichton novel, but we'll be talking about the 1993 science fiction movie, famously directed by Steven Spielberg. It's set on a remote island where a billionaire has recreated dinosaurs in a huge wildlife park cloned from prehistoric DNA. The millionaire invites some experts, Dr. Alan Grant, who's a paleontologist, Dr. Ellie Sattler, who's a paleobotanist, and Dr. Ian Malcolm, who's sort of there to big up the park before it opens. And then during the visit, oh dear, the security system fails. It all goes wrong. The dinosaurs escape. Chaos ensues. Hammond's grandchildren are there. Everybody's got to survive. What's going on the island? There's Tyrannosaurus Rex. There's Velociraptors. It's cracking fun. And it's a film kind of exploring themes of family and hubris, unpredictability, and just sort of a warning message really about, you know, putting massive dinosaurs in a park that you're then going to put children into. It was also an absolute banger of a groundbreaking movie with some special effects that still hold up today. Some really early CGI stuff that still looks really good today. So that's kind of like the top level synopsis. I mean, yeah, what's everybody else's kind of memory of it? I loved it. I still love it. I think it's a great movie.
So I started watching Jurassic Park I watched it for the first time far too young, probably. I was born in the same year it was released, so it turned 30 last year. And like you said, has aged amazingly. That kind of combination of animatronics and early CGI just still looks super convincing. I think it holds its own still in 2024. We were both released in the same year, and because I love dinosaurs so much, my parents decided it was a really good idea just to stick me in front of Jurassic Park, probably at about the age of four. And so much of it went over my head that, you know, as I rewatch it as an adult, I think this is terrifying. The velociraptors in the kitchen, the kids in the car in the T-Rex scene is all really scary. To a four-year-old, you're just kind of mesmerized by it all. And it's great fun.
My nephew, I think, loves it as well. He's five and he absolutely loves it. But from his perspective, it's a movie about naughty velociraptors and a Tyrannosaurus that's everybody's friend and saves them. Because you can, it turns out, watch the movie from the perspective of somebody who sees, like, oh no, they're being menaced by the velociraptor. Oh, the good Tyrannosaurus has come and scared them off. And you're like, oh, I suppose you can read it that way through, like, innocent little eyes.
That makes sense. I'm not sure the goat would see it that way.
Paul?
Jurassic Park is quite a seminal film, really, isn't it? It introduced me to a world of something that wasn't cartoons as I was growing up. I think it was the first, like, feature film that I watched that kind of opened my eyes to, animatronics and humans talking to each other, that not through the voiceover of a cartoon character. So yeah, it was my favorite kind of abiding memory is the water in the car.
Oh, in the cup. Yeah, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's always stuck with me on car journeys when I'm if I'm drinking and it wobbles, I automatically look behind me, you know.
I have a great fact about that, if I'm allowed to jump in.
Oh yeah.
Steven Spielberg got the idea for that. He was sitting in his van with a drink on the dashboard listening to Earth, Wind and Fire, and it made these perfect vibrating circles in the water. And so that's how he got the idea for that shot. But when they came to reproduce it in the actual scene itself, there was a guitar string underneath the dashboard. Someone just sitting twanging the guitar string, and it made these perfect circles reverberating in the water.
No expense spared.
That is excellent. That is absolutely excellent. So didn't peg Steven Spielberg as an EWAF fan. But
incredible.
There we go. And Katrina, am I right in thinking that you have only seen Jurassic Park once?
Maybe twice. I can't remember. I think I was too scared by the velociraptors in the kitchen scene to watch it again. And you're talking to the girl who was scared by that scene in the original Willy Wonka, where they, like, go up towards the fans and then get past that bit. So that's the level of cowardice we're looking at here. Dinosaurs were too much.
It is. So that's Jurassic Park. I suppose we should probably talk about sustainability. And I guess we're talking about sustainability in an education context, but it's one of those broad terms that's kind of papered over a lot of things. So can somebody give me just a very, very top level concept of what we're talking about sustainability, and then we'll go into sustainability in education and why it's important.
Sure. So in our context, we're thinking about sustainability in its broadest sense. First of all, it has lots of facets. So you could think about it from a kind of social justice point of view. You can think about it from a environmental point of view. There's lots of skills that you can develop and learn that can help you become more sustainable and work towards a sustainable future. So there's a concept called education for sustainable development, which is something that our work at the OU has connected with, that kind of helps to guide the student through the process of how they can become meaningfully connected with sustainability for their whatever their future entails. So it's the kind of the skills and experiences and knowledge that can transfer into your work or your kind of further studies. There's sustainability can be seen as a kind of have a stigma to it as well. So there are certain people that kind of, when you think of sustainability, you might automatically think of somebody who
wears hemp,
yes, or hugs trees, or is an eco warrior perhaps. And you might have seen the kind of controversies of people being sent to prison for sitting on a road.
Are we all roughly on the same page, by the way, with bang people up for 1,000 years for sitting on a road? It's probably a bit extreme.
It seems a little bit even.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Good. I just thought I'd check we were all on the same page of that before I accidentally dropped myself in it as some sort of radical lefty.
But what we're not endorsing any particular, you know, strand of eco warriorship. But what we're saying really is that sustainability is a broad brush as a concept, but it's about how you contextualize and consider it in your context, which makes it become more meaningful and less scary. So if you are trying to think about it in a kind of personal way, then you can consider what you yourself could do or learn that would impact your immediate surroundings, for example. You could think about it at a kind of global level.
Yeah. Well, can we dig a bit deeper then into sustainability in education? So what's sustainability in education? Why is it important?
Sustainability in education is, well, it's effectively that. So if we think about sustainability as making sure the planet is still there and able to host humans and nature...
Hold on to your butts, kids.
I know. That drastic idea that maybe we don't want to destroy the thing that we live off of. Sustainability in education is partly about what Paul mentioned about skills. So thinking about what skills do we need to make sure the planet is still there? What do we need to work together to achieve these things? It's also about the knowledge about sustainability. So like you said, it's not just about climate change or nature or anything like that, which is what we normally think about. It can also be about knowledge about poverty or economy or gender equality, things like that, things that make the world that we live in a better place. So
it's all social sustainability as well as environmental sustainability.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of about creating a... generation of people who have the skills, knowledge, values, and compassion to make it work. So they aren't just working for their own ends. We're all working to support each other to go forward. And through education is probably one of the most powerful ways that we can do that, because we can teach people to be like that, and we can shape people.
Be more sustainable.
That's the what we do when they don't listen, but hopefully shape people more gently to work towards a more sustainable future.
So this ties into that idea of graduate outcomes, which we've covered before on the show, that you set out with your learning outcomes, your educational aims, to try and have somebody at the end who can do some stuff or has a particular attribute. And am I right in thinking UNESCO have published new... Hayley, do you want to come in on this one?
Yeah, so UNESCO developed the Education for Sustainable Development Goals Learning Objectives in 2017, I think, and the report came out. So they've listed these competencies that, like Katrina said, they're setting out these ideas, these skills that people will need to work together to, you know, ultimately make the world a better, more equitable place. So there's 8 competencies. They're supposed to represent the kind of broad range of skills we'll need to deal with these challenges that we find ourselves kind of up against in the 21st century.
Take us through.
Shall I rattle them off? Cool. Systems thinking is the first one, the systems thinking competency. So about recognizing, understanding relationships, analyzing complex systems, and dealing with uncertainty, which obviously we have a massive amount of floating around at the moment. Anticipatory competency, so that's understanding and evaluating all these different scenarios for the future. So what's possible, what's probable, what's desirable, what can we kind of make out of these different scenarios that might be coming down the pipeline towards us. Creating your own vision for the future, assessing consequences of actions, dealing with risks and changes. The third competency is the normative competency. So that's all about understanding, reflecting on the norms and values that kind of underpin our own actions, the things that we soak up from society around us, I guess, and how that impacts what we do. And negotiating in a sustainability context, so negotiating sustainability values, different principles, goals, again, in that context of uncertainty, conflicts of interest, uncertain knowledge, contradictions, and all the rest of it. The fourth one is the strategic competency. So this one is all around collectively developing and implementing innovative action solutions that are going to further sustainability, as Paul mentioned, at a local level, but also on that kind of global scale further afield. So you can think about it on different scales, I think. The fifth of the eight competencies is collaboration. And as Katrina said, this is a really big, really important one, I think. So learning from others, understanding, respecting others' needs and perspectives and actions. So it's all of that kind of social sustainability thing as well is really key here. The sixth one is critical thinking. So kind of what it says on the tin, being able to question the norms and practices and opinions that are around us, sort of evaluating information that comes our way. And then also reflecting on our own values and our own perceptions of the information that we come across, I guess. Number seven, I think, is quite closely linked to that. So we have the self-awareness competency, and that is around being able to reflect on our own role in our local community, but again, also on that global stage. So where do we fit into this big sustainability picture? Evaluating our own actions and dealing with our own feelings and desires. And then lastly, we've got the kind of biggie that brings it all together. So integrated problem solving. So being able to apply different problem solving frameworks to these complex problems that we're facing, and then developing viable, inclusive and equitable solutions. I think that's really key to bring in that kind of social sustainability again, that integrate all of these other competencies.
So kind of, yeah, so drawing it all together. That's a big ask, isn't it? I mean, this feels like this could be an entire qualification, just being a sustainable human being in the 21st century.
Yeah, definitely. And part of what Hayley spoke through is grouped into three categories as well. So there's ways of thinking, being and practicing. That those
So ways of thinking, ways of being and ways of practicing. That's like the three top level.
Yeah.
That's much easier to hold in my head, three little things. So I'm going to write that down.
It helps to, make it feel more manageable, right?
It feels like Bruce Lee as well. Don't think, be, and practice. Wait, hang on. No, I got that wrong. So the reason that we're talking about sustainability with these three people in particular is not just because they happened to be on campus today and I thought, oh, brilliant, ambush time. Love the opportunity to sit down with some microphones and some fan-fearless people, but also because between the three of you, you've been doing a huge amount of work sustainability, not just at the OU, but also more broadly. We originally pitched this episode off the back of Alt-C last year, where Paul and Hayley had done a piece, and then you're planning for Alt-C this year. Am I right in that?
Not Alt-C, but we have presented at a similar sounding acronym, the EAUC, this year. And Paul and I are currently, watch this space, trying to write a book chapter about the work that we've been doing as well.
Oh, congrats for a book.
I can't remember the title of it, which is unhelpful, but it's a sustainability compendium. Yeah, we can.
Are we Googling it?
I'll find the title. Okay. Just give me
we'll put in the placeholder at Beano Annual 2025 for now. It's going to be sandwiched in between the Bash Street Kids and the fella who eats big pies. No, no way, he's from the Dandy, isn't he? And Hayley, do you want to talk about your sustainability work as well?
Yeah, so I went with Paul to the Alt Conference last September. That was the 30th anniversary of the Alt Conference, I believe, which kind of gave us the Jurassic Park idea. It was tying in with the 30th anniversary thing. So Paul and I presented on ways of embedding sustainability into module design, into course design. We had a really nice kind of interactive session with great attendance at Alt.
And it led on to some of our work being published within a open learn course. So the some of the visualizations of the sustainability competencies, which we created as different trees. So there's a tree for ways of being, ways of thinking, and ways of practicing are embedded within a open learn course, which we can put in the show notes.
Oh yeah, they're definitely put in the show notes.
And then we also have off the back of that as well, we have a page on open learn that showcases some of our resources too. So
is it, so sustainability, obviously you've all been working on it a lot over the last couple of years. I mean, is it this academic cycles, you know, thing, or is it here to stay? Is it only going to build from here?
I'm going to answer that question in a second, but I've just found the book title to have the book title, which is Education for Sustainable Development, The Contribution of Universities.
Ah.
And so, yeah, we're writing a case study within the chapter that will explore the work related to some of our work that was presented at Alt Conference and beyond. So.
I would have also accepted 50 Shades of Green.
Yeah.
So back to my question.
Yeah.
It's basically, is this the flavor of the month? Because we've all been in kind of these cycles of, like, you know, I don't want to say like the fad, but there's always kind of like the big ethical thing that the universities focus on, and it gets a bit of funding, and then it kind of either gets operationalized a little bit, or it kind of, like, you know, gets sort of gently put to one side and become yet another framework or tick box exercise for the next big thing that takes over. Is sustainability that, or is sustainability only going to build and grow from here?
Sustainability, it is definitely not a fad. I would suggest that it's an all-encompassing umbrella that actually connects with more than you initially might think it does. So we were talking with a colleague this morning actually about how sustainability is actually an umbrella of EDIA work. So we attended a conference talk at the EAUC conference in Winchester this year, and it was about how sustainability and inclusivity are interconnected, and sustainability is the kind of broader umbrella that sits, that inclusivity and EDI work can sit within quite comfortably. So on the surface level, I could understand why people might think that sustainability is a kind of new fad that will go away once it stops getting so hot, but I think that realistically, once you scratch away the onion layers, you can begin to see how it's actually really integrated into every part of our lives in most senses.
Okay, so is there anything else you want to say sustainability before we move on to the second part of our show where we answer our stupid question? No? Okay.
Part two.
There we go.
The answer.
Okay, so what can Jurassic Park teach us about embedding sustainability in course design? So thus far we've talked about the top level principles of sustainability, we've talked about the UNESCO skills competencies, and we've talked about Jurassic Park. Who wants to have a bash at starting to bring these together?
I'll kick off if that's okay. So I'm gonna pull out some examples of how Jurassic Park kind of connects with some of those competencies that we spoke about earlier, and that can help us answer the question hopefully. So the characters in Jurassic Park, they fail to anticipate the consequences of their actions. So for example, Dr. Hammond thinks that he can control the dinosaurs. He's spoiler alert, he's wrong. This teaches us that we need to be able to think ahead and try to predict potential outcomes of our decisions. And if we take that logic into our education, kind of considering the consequences of our actions in most contexts can be a really useful skill to develop and learn and consider.
So that's the anticipatory competency. So this is a cautionary tale, is what you're saying. This should be part of the curriculum as a case study.
Yes.
Okay. And so next up, I mean, Hayley.
So systems thinking is that first competency that we spoke about. This is, I think, in Jurassic Park, we can think about how interconnected everything is. So we're bringing dinosaurs back to life. They're disrupting the entire ecosystem of whatever else was going on that island when the park was created. And I think the message that it sends kind of very broadly, very bluntly with velociraptors is to think really carefully about the potential impact of our actions. So not just on the environment around us, but on society, on the people around us as well. So it's a kind of quite blunt instrument to do that with, I think. But I was going to talk about how much chaos theory comes up in Jurassic Park. And I think it comes up more in the book, although I haven't read the book for a really long time. But Ian Malcolm, Jeff Goldblum's character, talks about a butterfly flapping its wings in one place and a hurricane being the result somewhere else. So that idea of, yeah, that impact that small actions, seemingly small actions, can have elsewhere, although chaos theory is totally beyond me and I can't talk about it in any more detail other than Jeff Goldblum quotes.
Well, there's like a math thing well with chaos theory, isn't there, as well, which gets into it. And then people start talking about quantum and you're like...
And then it will get a bit much.
But yeah, it's that whole, because we've talked about systems thinking on the podcast before in the context of, actually the movie, The Butterfly Effect with Yitzha. Really good recording. Let's talk a lot about Ashton Kutcher, which is always a nice thing to do.
Definitely.
But yeah, it's all about the complexity and interconnectedness of the various systems what your scope is, trying to actively hunt down and understand those connections and how they interact. So that you don't have a butterfly flap its wings in Peru and a velociraptor eat somebody's face in... whereabouts in the world is Jurassic Park set?
Wasn't it Costa Rica?
It was, yeah.
Costa Rica? Yeah. There's a bit of a blooper in one of the first scenes when, you know, Dennis goes to meet the guy with the can of dinosaur embryos. And they're meant to be in San Jose, which is landlocked, but they're at a beach bar.
Ah.
Yeah.
That's true. It was a Unix system there, so...
So, moving on with our competencies, Katrina?
Yes, so normative competency, which is basically thinking about norms and values that underlie your actions. So why is it that you choose to do something? What is your normality? And why might that be different to someone else's? So in the context of Jurassic Park, that's kind of, why have they decided it's okay to bring dinosaurs back and put them in a big theme park?
When you say it like that, I mean...
It is a little bit cruel. Like, it's like zoos, isn't it? But for dinosaurs. But it's kind of thinking about how our actions can have negative impacts on the environment and future generations. But also in the context of negotiating sustainability, it's thinking about why for one individual, sustainability may not feel... like the obvious answer or the sustainable action might not be something that is natural to them. So, for example, field work or going out to support Indigenous communities, who the whole reason why they may not be able to engage with climate action is because of poverty, which is fueled by the act of perhaps Western imperialism and so on and so forth. So their norms are more complicated than just they don't want to be sustainable. And then in Jurassic Park, that thinking of the norms and why they're there is embodied by Ian Malcolm or Jeff Goldblum's character. And he's very much the voice of reason throughout the film, kind of.
Which for a Jeff Goldblum role is unusual.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Weird bloke. Cool bloke, weird bloke. Only ever plays Jeff Goldblum in every movie he's in.
Or does he only ever play Ian Malcolm?
You're right.
Really? I was going to say there was an interview with him in The Guardian maybe a couple of weeks ago, and the guy interviewing him said he always plays between 50 and 90% Jeff Goldblum in every film he's ever been in, which I enjoyed.
Oh, I enjoy him. I enjoy him a lot. Was he in, I'm thinking of Nicolas Cage, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
I'm only imagining that his response was, that's one big pile of shit.
That's the second quote, third quote so far. Depending on which ones make the edit.
It really depends on your edit.
Yeah. So we're working away for the competencies. So next up was the strategic competency.
That's right, yeah. So the characters in Jurassic Park develop a plan to stop the dinosaurs from escaping and also to escape from the dinosaurs. And this teaches us that we need to be able to develop and implement strategies to help achieve our goals. So the example from the film would be, is that, you know, it gives female characters quite a bit to do in terms of the strategy for securing the park, and the main characters ultimately get away from the situation mostly unscathed, with the exception of a few, you know, non-main characters.
NPCs.
Yes.
Just basically ambulatory props.
Exactly, yeah. But the I think Jurassic Park is so great because it has that strong female lead. So there's Lex, which is Hammond's granddaughter, is a hacker, so she can work the computer system. You know, there's the Ellie is the main paleontologist.
The paleobotanist.
Paleobotanist.
Sorry to be picky.
Oh, motherfucker. Sorry. Can you delete that?
No.
No.
So button's broken.
She's the main, what Haley just said. But the point is, the strategic competency isn't exclusively male in this film. And I think that it's actually almost predominantly female. And I think that's a real positive message.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of movies where, there's that particular test. We won't get into this. I think we've talked about this.
Oh, the Bechdel test.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a movie that actually passes the test, which is a surprisingly small number. So next up would have been the collaboration competency.
Yeah, so I think this is one where Jurassic Park and its kind of story arc fits the bill really, really nicely. It's, we can think about collaboration in the sense of these, this strange kind of disparate, if that's the right word, group of people is brought together by John Hammond in the park. So you have Ian Malcolm, the caretaker, you have paleontologist, paleobotanist, his grandchildren, like a really strange motley crew of people. Not that his grandchildren are brought in to be experts in any way, but just kind of test, you know, how much fun this is going to be before everyone gets eaten. But they go on this lovely story arc of, yeah, starting off as that group of people who don't know each other, don't really like each other very much. And then by the end, Alan Grant in particular, Sam Neill's character, is like working with the kids, feels quite protective of them. They're working as a team, using their different skills. Like Paul said, so Lex is the hacker. And I think originally in the book, Tim was the hacker. So we have that gender flip, which I really like, that Spielberg pulled off in the film. We have them working together, using their different skills to become that team that ultimately escapes relatively unscathed, as we said. Like, you know, NPCs can be placed to one side, maybe.
The people that we care about at the end of the movie. And I think it's something to pluck out with the first Jurassic Park movie, but also I think the next two that went after is The Lost World and the Lost World 2 Electric Boogaloo, whatever it was called. They're also movies about forming like proxy families. So it's kind of disjointed people who like are either not in a family or not in kind of like a cohesive family, basically forming sort of proxy familial units of kind of, you know, parent-children kind of dynamics and the love and the care that goes along with it, which I always really like. So it's a very sort of Spielberg theme. And it's just, it always feels like that's actually the main theme of the sort of the hero's journey of the movies. And the dinosaurs are just sort of there at the same time, rather than kind of your Michael Bay's of there's a dinosaur and it's exploded and now it's a car. kind of thing.
It means you get something quite heartwarming out of a film that, you know, you could see as just people being ripped limb from limb and the sound effects that go with that. So yeah, you get something really, really nice and convivial about it.
Do you have a bit of trivia for us on the sounds, on how they made it? Was it done with go on.
Oh, I do. So you know how the lawyer is eaten from the toilet? He's plucked off the toilet in that T-Rex scene. He goes and hides and leaves the kids.
When you gotta go, you gotta go.
I need a bell to ring. sorry.
And it's from that scene as well.
Yes.
It's perfect. So the T-Rex picks him up from the toilet and shakes him, and that was just a dog shaking a toy. That's all it was. It was a dog shaking some kind of, not even a squeaky toy, but
I think
that's quite a nice sound effect. My other favourite one, or probably my very favourite one, is that the Velociraptor's calling their friends, which I won't try and...
Oh, please try.
Yeah, you can't not now.
I really can't, but I can tell you. So you can kind of imagine the sound. That was either turtles or tortoises. I think tortoises mating. So that's really why I'm not going to be able to
also sound, watch this movie again in the same light.
Yeah.
Oh, they really spared no expense with the sound effects, I think.
Do you reckon they just gave the dog a tortoise to shake? So next up would be critical thinking.
Yes, which arguably there wasn't an awful lot of at the beginning of this film, putting, again, dinosaurs in a zoo. Not a good idea.
You're arguing that billionaires aren't necessarily very good at critical thinking.
I think that would be a sound argument, yes.
Outrageous. That's us cancelled on Twitter again.
So critical thinking, which actually there is some academic debate about whether this is a sustainability competency, because it's a general academic competency, but we won't get into that. There's lots of kerfuffle backwards and forwards about competencies and what are competencies and what should they be called and what's the label.
God,
and
why every time the semantics?
All the semantics, all that fun stuff, which we won't get into because I think it's easier to go with what we got. But in this case, the characters in Jurassic Park obviously have to critically think about the dinosaurs and how they behave and how they're going to dodge them in order to try and survive, which we know some of them don't. And it's very hand in hand with the collaboration competency in this world and in the real world, which is a good thing to point out, because all of these competencies are very intrinsically interlinked and you kind of can't really have one without developing all of the others. You kind of need all eight to be a sustainable citizen. But from the context of the film, it kind of teaches us that we need to be able to think critically about the world around us. And for example, think about the velociraptors and Robert Muldoon. Muldoon. How do you say that?
Muldoon.
Robert Muldoon and the velociraptors. He's very familiar with their behaviours and capabilities. He knows how they behave in the wild. So he uses his critical thinking skills to survive for a little bit, but ultimately can't really outsmart them. Maybe not the best advert for critical thinking. But yeah, so thinking about behaviours, I've lost my thread of thought now, so I'm going to
talk
about critical thinking.
I think the worst advert for critical thinking in the film is, what's the IT guy? Who is like
Dennis.
Yeah, he's like, oh, I'm gonna switch the fences off to create a distraction so that I can escape with all the embryos, forgetting that he's got to escape through they then got to escape through a load of dinosaurs that are gonna eat his face. To be fair, that's probably anticipatory thinking as well as critical thinking. But just thinking. There's a thinking.
This is how they all come together. This is how they're all connected.
Is this that
all those competencies?
What were those three groupings again?
Ways of being, thinking, and practicing.
Oh, so ways of thinking. And in this top level one, I mean, did anybody else have anything to add to the critical thinking? I'm thinking particularly quotes and trivia.
I was just thinking that I'm just going to call this quote out because it fits quite well. So Ian Malcolm said, "God creates dinosaurs. God destroys dinosaurs. God creates man. Man destroys God. Man creates dinosaurs." And then Ellie says, "Dinosaurs eat men. Women inherit the earth." So that's a kind of, I think what that really is saying is that critical thinking at its best is how to consider the situation and it ensure that women end up on top, I think is what's happening.
I did have I had another Ellie Sattler quote actually about because I think she's the one who twigs first that this probably isn't going to be a very good idea. And there's that really nice scene where she's sitting with John Hammond and they're both eating ice cream and she talks about how she was in awe of the power of this place and, you know, actually maybe John, maybe we should rethink this. She gets it quickest and she's most on the ball with the, if not the anticipatory thinking from the start, then, you know, she's able to evaluate her part in this and, I think she sees it the quickest out of all of them.
So self-awareness competency would be the next one. So who wants to take that?
Yeah, I'll go for it. So I think it's worth noting from a kind of being self-aware about the different competency frameworks. Do you see where I'm going here? Is that just to acknowledge that there is a whole raft of kind of frameworks and approaches to considering sustainability that exist, and UNESCO isn't the only one. It was commonly in the literature, though, it's kind of considered that the competencies kind of are what they are, and they're just a sort of series of rebrandings. And I'm massively condensing that argument in the literature, but so it's worth just acknowledging that whilst we're talking about the UNESCO ones, we are aware that there are lots of kind of competing frameworks, so to speak, but they all kind of broadly say the same thing. And actually there's been part of our work that we're doing at the moment is kind of representing that debate in and acknowledging that it's a good thing that they're all saying the same thing to a certain extent.
Well, it's that thing, isn't it, of no model/framework is true, but some are useful.
Yes, exactly.
And don't get too hung up on that, as you said earlier. Don't get too hung up on the debate around the semantics. It's like, what's the actual intent of this? What does this help me do?
Yeah, exactly. So
where's the connection with Jurassic Park,
though? I know, just, you know, I thought I'd just throw out a academic sense check.
Okay, I say, but are raptors self-aware? I guess is what I'm asking. Like, are they sentient?
So, in our opinion, we think that probably the two most self-aware characters in the film are Ellie Sattler and Alan Grant, because they both quickly become the most switched on to the danger that they're all in. And I think John Hammond, as we've kind of touched on already, was very caught up in his vision of the park, but doesn't really develop the awareness and the of the gravity of the situation. So Dennis Nedry, who's we just spoke about earlier, depending on the edit of the episode, who's Wayne Knight's character, he's one who steals the embryos, but he's very aware of his own situation as well. So I kind of guess in a way he's quite self-aware, but in a very different sense. So he's driven by kind of self-interest, so maybe not so much self-aware as what we would want to nurture and develop in students. But in terms of its connection with characters, I think it's present in different ways in Jurassic Park, self-awareness.
And of course you got, so it's Alan and Ellie.
Mm.
And that's where I sort of talked earlier about their sort of becoming proxy parents to the two kids for kind of like, you know, the duration of the emergency, or possibly afterwards. Maybe they stay in touch after the film. That'd be nice. But that's very much them demonstrating an awareness of kind of their place in this sort of the emergent social unit. They're kind of their place in the micro community that forms within the context of the movie. So the last one, the last competency is integrated problem solving.
Yeah, so this one, I think I'm probably going to have to revisit some of the other competencies to sort of string some of these together, but then I guess that's what integrated problem solving is. But I'm thinking of the individual skill sets that the characters have, which we've touched on already. So we have the hacking, which Lex does. Ellie Sattler's the paleobotanist who works out that, is it West Indian lilac is poisonous to Triceratops, and, you know, saves the Triceratops in one of the earlier scenes. Alan Grant's all up on his dinosaur behavior and breeding patterns. He works out what's going on, even though they've all been created as female dinosaurs, how they've been able to breed. Ian Malcolm is just there being extremely quotable with his deplorable excess of personality. But they all have something to contribute, I think. And it's about bringing those individual skill sets together, which work in their own context, applying it to this new context no one's ever been in, where dinosaurs are let loose in a theme park, and learning on the hoof, I guess, how to apply their own skills to this new situation. And like you say, they start off as that disparate group of people. They have that lovely story arc of becoming a proxy family, becoming a proper team who can work together and function in that new challenging environment, which I guess is what all of this is about ultimately, is tackling the challenges that we've got facing us, you know, in lots of different senses around the world at the moment. Misinformation being one of them, but, you know, the social issues, environmental issues that all form part of this. I think it's about, thinking about how we can apply things that we're interested in, things that we're good at, to try to start to remedy that situation, maybe.
And then the clock is very much ticking as well on the whole thing in the real world context. So that's us having moved through the competencies, and I want to just thank you all for masterfully matching those competencies to moments and quotes in the film. And worry not, Hayley, I'm going to add a special section at the end for any trivia that you weren't able to deploy.
Oh, thank you.
But let's just return to our question then. So I think we've answered this already kind of in long form, but I'd like to just sort of challenge each of you to maybe try and have a crack at answering in short form. What can Jurassic Park teach us about embedding sustainability in course design?
So I think what Jurassic Park does best is help us to consider what values really mean. And so when we're thinking about the values of the characters and the journey that they go on, so from kind of thinking that they are doing this amazing thing and then kind of, you know, having the perilous experience that they have and coming through it with the skills that they develop, which we explored, I think the key to that is that how their values change in relation to those skills. So they might start out with an idea of the way in which they intended that experience to be, but actually through their development and understanding and growth within that process of the film, they can think about how actually it's okay to change your values as you learn a bit more, and you might think about things slightly differently than you originally thought you ever would, maybe.
Transformation. I like it.
I think possibly Jurassic Park is a good tale of caution of what happens when you maybe don't embed sustainability competencies in people's lives and education experiences. Because if someone had the confidence and wherewithal to kind of stand up and say, actually, no, I don't think this is a good idea, or have we thought about this the whole way around rather than being financially driven, which I think we see quite a lot in our world, unfortunately, because capitalism, it might not have turned out the way that it did. So I think it feels a bit blue sky, rainbowy thinking that just by embedding these things, we can lead to maybe a more positive worldview. But I think there's no harm in that. Maybe it's nice to be a bit rainbowy every now and again.
So. And the rainbow doesn't necessarily have to be a park full of dinosaurs.
No, maybe a pot of gold at the end rather than a park full of dinosaurs.
And capitalism love pots of gold, famously. Are you listening, capitalism? We've got your back.
Yeah, I agree. So I think Jurassic Park is that kind of cautionary tale about, if you have a lack of anticipatory thinking, if you have a lack of critical thinking, and we talked about misinformation a bit earlier on, or touched on it kind of briefly, and the chaos that can ensue from the kind of situations that we've seen recently in the spread of misinformation. So I think Jurassic Park teaches us a lot about, really sitting with an idea, really thinking about it and considering it from all these different angles, but also the breadth of skills that are needed, the breadth of skills that are useful in tackling really complex challenges, like in Jurassic Park or like in the real world. We see these three different areas, these three different skill sets, so ways of thinking, being, doing, how they can be applied either to a dinosaur theme park or to the real world. And I think there's something for everyone within those. It's not that absolutely everyone has to be able to do all of them or be amazing at all of them, but you can work as part of that team, that disparate group of people who each bring something different to the table, and you complement each other in a sense, I think. So yeah, I think there's something for everyone within those competencies, within those sustainability skills.
That's fabulous.
There's one more thing that Jurassic Park teaches us, and that's the best two jokes that have ever come in the film. And they are, what do you call a blind dinosaur?
Do you think he saw us?
Correct. I'm expecting some laugh.
Oh, hang on. I have got a laugh somewhere. I've got to scroll through my sound effects to find it. Let's see.
Okay,
here we go.
Nice.
There we go.
And what do you call a blind dinosaur's dog?
Do you think he saw us, Rex?
There you go.
I probably should have faded those in. sort of professional podcast person would have done. Okay, so with our question answered, let's go into the third and final part of the show. Well, not quite final, but the third and final part of the show, we talk about tips of practice, which I think we might want to focus on the actual embedding. So how you actually embed this in your curriculum, course design, and teaching practice.
Part 3. Practical tips.
Okay, so somebody who's been listening so far now has a pretty good knowledge of dinosaur jokes, what happens in the Jurassic Park movies, and of course, understands the UNESCO sustainability competencies. How do they go about integrating that in their own education?
So one of the most important lessons that we've learned quite recently is actually to try and not embed it. I know, it's more about embodying. So you, as yourself, you can embody what it might mean to use these skills, or to show people how they might be embedded and empower them to learn from that, rather than going to somebody and saying, oh, this is how you should embed this. So imagine I'm talking to somebody who's just no interest in talking to me about sustainability, and going to that person and saying, you know, I think this and this is probably the best way to do this thing that you've spent your whole life, you know, researching and writing about, and it might come across in a sense that they wouldn't accept that. Hmm. Whereas if you're embodying kind of examples and empowering them to come to that point themselves, I think that's the strongest way to help embed.
Any advances on that?
I think another way to help people consider how they might embed or work with sustainability is beginning with meeting them where they're at. So not everyone can become sustainability experts in a day.
Like the three of you.
Like the three of us, obviously.
Naturally.
The foremost sustainability experts, the Open University official.
Well.
On this podcast.
On this podcast, yeah.
Let's carry at it with that. But it's accepting that obviously we've been doing this for a little while now, not as long as some people, and I still sometimes struggle to get my head around the competencies and how they interlink and how you actually turn them into from these theoretical things into practical actions, which you get students to do and embody and inhabit. And I think that that's okay. And I think that kind of openness and truthfulness with the people you're working with and academics can help make it feel more accessible. Mm-hmm. But also sometimes it's going, okay, well, you're doing an English module, which doesn't necessarily naturally link itself to some sustainability concepts. So let's just see where we can meet you and let's start along that road. And it's okay if we don't get everything embedded in, and if it's not completely linked to sustainability in an ideal world, it would be. But yeah, let's just try and start this journey together. And I think it can make it feel a little bit less intimidating than going, no, we have to have every competency in, we have to have it linked to sustainability, and every sustainable development goal has to be pinpointed some point in here.
Oh, but universities love an arbitrary framework that you've gone to somehow bend your teaching towards. So I really like that. And it's that big thing of more is always more than none, isn't it? And if you're going to be beating people over the head with everything, then it makes so much more sense to meet them halfway and fall, as you said, making it so that it's not just one more thing, it's something that you're modeling, a context and environment that you're creating. Hayley, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I definitely think it's about meeting people where they are. So considering their own individual context as well in terms of subject areas. So the thing about having a skills-based or a competency-based framework is that you can kind of apply it to any subject area. So like Katrina said, English, which you wouldn't think necessarily is a prime candidate for, you know, making a course with embedded sustainability principles. But I think reframing sustainability as something, it doesn't have to be about carbon capture or emissions or, you know, any of the things we spoke about earlier, lithium-ion batteries or whatever. It can be about these skills, about relating to other people in your world and in the wider world, and creating a more sustainable future together within that context. So you're thinking about how to, I guess, nurture and embody these skills in your students, which is going to set them up for success, hopefully, in their own lives and careers, and also have that added bonus of contributing to a sustainable future as well. So in that sense, I guess everyone's a winner.
I absolutely love it. And it feels like all three of those complement each other really nicely. You're modeling it, you're creating the context for it, you're meeting people halfway and you're going, what does this look like in your context? This isn't a bat. Sustainability is not yet another top-down thing to, it's something that we can look and see how it applies in your area, what it might look like, and how we can get it to work for you and hopefully produce good outcomes for the students that you have.
And if you wanted some help in that context, obviously our resources that were mentioned are going to be linked in the show notes, and you know they're freely available to use and adapt.
Yeah, because you've got those. It wasn't just the trees, was it? Skill cards as well you'd made?
That's right, yeah. So with student feedback, we developed and created some sustainability skills cards that help to contextualize the different UNESCO competencies into kind of actionable things that you can do. So whether that be as part of learning outcomes or activity design, it helps you to kind of have a starting point at which to think, how could I actually do this thing? And then, you know, you can develop and tweak it from there. So
they are very useful, and they're also, you know, they're nicely designed. It's always nice to have a nice thing. Thank you so much, Hayley, Paul and Katrina, for answering this. I must admit, so sustainability for me has always felt like just another thing to try and wrap my head around, and quite an intimidating one, particularly when you're trying to hold, you know, 16,000 other frameworks in your head simultaneously. So that concept of it as an umbrella and working out just how to apply it in your own context, I think has been really, really useful for me. Unless anybody has anything else to add, I'm going to close off the show. But before that, I'll add in a short bonus section of additional Jurassic Park trivia, because I know Hayley has loads of it and I love Jurassic Park trivia. Bonus section, Jurassic Park trivia. Hayley, here's.
Oh gosh, okay. So my favourite scene, I think, is that iconic T-Rex scene in the rain where of course it's a she because they're all female, breaks out of her enclosure shortly after the goat gets eaten. And it was basically so big, the scene that Spielberg had planned, that they couldn't use the Universal sound stage. There was nothing big enough or I think waterproof enough to film it at Universal. So they had to go to Warner Brothers and use their sound stage there. And the T-Rex that you see is mostly animatronics. We talked about the animatronics and the CGI earlier. They built a great big puppet T-Rex to use for this scene, and just soaked it continually in rain on this soundstage for the duration of all these takes that they did, which looked great, but meant the T-Rex got a bit kind of clunky and a bit jerky and didn't work very well when it got very wet. So they employed somebody to climb inside the T-Rex, the animatronic T-Rex, and dry it from the inside, because it had this beautiful kind of painted skin. I don't know what the skin was made of, and all of the metal contraptions, gears and whatnot inside, they had to dry in between those layers. The only way you could do it was from the inside. And there was a bit of a sketchy moment where it started to move again with this person and their little hand towel or whatever. Oh. Right. Inside the T-Rex, they were fine as far as I know. No fatalities on the set of Jurassic Park, but yeah, it's the lengths that they went to, it's pretty impressive. The other really cool thing about that scene, I think, is, you know, there's that great shot where you're looking down from the T-Rex's point of view into the car, kind of through the glass, and the kids are screaming in the bottom of the car. The window wasn't supposed to break. So the fear that they have in that shot is genuine. Yeah.
I can remember the scream as well. Like, I can picture the scream.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's real.
That's excellent.
Which is,
there's a thing like that in Die Hard, isn't there? Where the first Die Hard movie, Alan Rickman being pushed off the thing. He wasn't expecting it.
Yeah.
He didn't know it was coming.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah, the look on his face in slow-mo is actually like a real, like, oh, shit. Is he good? I mean, it's not off an actual building. I think they green screened it, but or would it have been blue screened back in the day?
Probably blue, I guess. Yeah,
it would have been blue screened. But yeah, okay, that's cool. Okay, rule of threes. Do you want to throw one more nugget in before I close the show off?
I've got one more, which is kind of related to that Alan Rickman one. So the falling off of something. Lex falls out of the ventilator. That's not the right ventilation
duct. Yeah.
Duct. Yeah, she falls out of it. And in the final version that we see, she looks up directly at the camera, and it's definitely Lex that we see. But it was a stunt double who did that take and accidentally looked up at the camera. And so it's one of the first instances of superimposing an actor's face onto a stunt double's face completely by chance. You know, they didn't plan for it to happen, but needed to use that shot, I guess. So superimposed. I can't remember what the actor's name is. Lex, anyway, the Lex actor.
That's so cool.
That's incredible. When he looks up at the camera. So
I bet they spared no expense with that CGI.
You know what? If, there's a really good YouTube channel called Corridor Crew, and they do VFX artists react, where they break down brilliant and awful VFX from a technical perspective, and some of it is delicious, and the old stuff particularly is just incredible. Like it's so good.
So cool.
Paul, you got any like quotes burning in you? I think Paul's been possibly vibrating with quotes this
time. I wanted to conclude just by saying, on behalf of all of us, Mike, just remind Pedagodzilla to thank us for a lovely weekend.
I thought you were going to go into something like, you'd spent so long thinking about if you could do it that you didn't think about, oh, I can't even remember the quote.
Whether you could, you didn't stop to think if you should.
Okay, edit that out, because that's a much better one. Okay, hang on.
Okay. Hey, Paul, got any organic final quotes you want to throw into the mix?
I'm trying to find it.
I feel like Haley has it like tattooed somewhere.
I've got it. Side of her list. Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could do it, they didn't stop to think if they should. And I'm eyeballing
this. It's really eyeballing me. He's really knocked eyes on me on that one. Well, that feels like a nice, uncomfortable way to end the episode. Cool. Well, Hayley, Paul, Katrina, thank you so much for taking the time to basically just talk me through sustainability and have a lovely chat about Jurassic Park. This is the second and a half time we've actually tried to do this. And I think this has been, come out really well. So thank you so much for your time. Before I close the episode off, is there anything you would like to plug?
Just our resources that we've already kind of mentioned, I suppose. So the other thing is to mention, and I haven't run this past Mike, but there was a competition for how many quotes you could spot in this episode, and if you guess it right and tell Mike the number on Twitter, he'll send you a badge or something, I'm sure.
I do have a badge somewhere. I could probably send you a badge. I'll send you a badge and a bookmark.
There you go.
There we go. Cool. Well, in which case, thank you so much for listening. Let's close this off.
Oh, that's so foul.
Okay, lad. Thank you very much for listening. You can subscribe to us on all of your favorite apps, feeds, iTunes, and at our website, pedagogzilla.com. You can also follow us and get in touch via Twitter. I am at pedagogzilla.
I'm at Astles Paul.
At Matty, I think.
I am at Hayley_Johns_. We know Sam Neill followed me.
And we know Sam Neill followed you.
Not yet.
But it's to happen soon.
Where we hope. So all of the resources we talk about on the show will be in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening. We love the locks, and we'll see you next time with Pedagogzilla. Bye now.